Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Hi, welcome to Connecting Faith. Thank you once again for tuning in. You know, every day we get together here and always appreciate the opportunity to interact with you and to get some feedback and find ways that we can help connect faith to life. We love to, on the program Connecting Faith, take biblical principles and apply them to daily life. Or in our case today, we want to apply them, apply biblical truths to the world in which we live and the views of which many ascribe to. And we're going to find, I think, some important teaching today. So, Ted, I don't know, do you have your thinking cap on today?
Strap it on tight.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. I was thinking about having Nancy on and how our culture, just like maybe 50 years ago, use that as an arbitrary number, was probably a little more open to all things Christian, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
You could say you're a Christian without any fear of repercussions.
Yeah.
Now it seems to have changed, don't you think?
Yeah, and almost a sort of really kind of a derision, I think, right? That why would you believe that? There's no, you know, what's the substance of that? And so we're going to find out today. In fact, the book that our guest Nancy Piercy has just written just came out, in fact, the first of the month, called Finding Truth, which is, is a big a big topic, and we're going to dive right in. And, you know, if you've read Romans chapter 1 recently, you know there's some important teaching there from the Apostle Paul, and that's going to be the basis for our conversation, at least in giving some strategies, some principles that we can use for, as the subtitle of the book Finding Truth says, five principles for unmasking atheism, secularism, and other God substitutes. And maybe your kids are facing some of that in the university or high school, or maybe you get it at work, or you're struggling, have some questions on your own about the reality of the Christian faith. Well, Nancy Piercy is author of Total Truth, Liberating Christianity from Its Cultural Captivity, which was a 2005 Gold Medallion Award-winning book and a recommended reading. She also co-wrote with Harold Fickett and Chuck Colson, How Now Shall We Live?, another book you should have on your shelf, and her latest now, Finding Truth, Five Principles for Unmasking Atheism, Secularism, and Other God Substitutes. Formerly an agnostic, she studied under Francis Schaeffer at Le Bris in Switzerland and has earned an M.A. from Covenant Theological Seminary and pursued further graduate work in history of philosophy at the Institute for Christian Studies in Toronto. She's currently teaching in Houston, and is actually she's one of us. She's an upper Midwesterner, so we always love having Nancy Piercy back on Connecting Faith. Welcome to the program, Nancy.
Thank you. Good to be here, Neil.
So let's talk about the Finding Truth. I mean, you've written Total Truth. Maybe just to, in terms of kind of a snapshot summary, what's different about Finding Truth from your great book Total Truth out 10 years ago?
Well, Total Truth made the case for bringing Christianity into the public square, connecting faith to the public issues of our day. Finding Truth gives people the tools to do it. It draws out five principles from Romans 1 that penetrate to the core of any worldview, whether it's a secular worldview or a religious one, in order to analyze its weaknesses, show where it fails, and present Christianity as a positive alternative. So it challenges the mindset of don't think, just believe. It helps Christians to understand how to make the case for Christianity in a way that will stand up in the public square, talking with non-Christians, talking with secular professors at your university or your colleagues at work. So it gives people the tools to do what Total Truth told them to do. This enables them to actually do it.
I guess I'd wondered, too, if some of these principles, I mean, if this is something that it will just help us better understand what other people think, or is there, another reason that we need to do this? It's not just so we can, I guess, be more aware, is it?
Well, yeah, it's both. On one hand, our job is to communicate the gospel, and the first law of effective communication is know your audience. So understanding non-Christian worldviews is essential if we're going to talk to people who are thinking secular thoughts, who are thinking secular worldviews, or even non-Christian religious worldviews. Obviously, you need to know how they think in order to express the biblical message in a way that they will understand. I also, of course, I'm working at a Christian university now, and one of my deepest concerns is the large number of young people who are losing their faith when they go off to college or the workplace and don't have the tools for understanding how to defend their Christian convictions against the secular onslaught of ideas. Let me give you an example. This was the most recent example I ran into. I was speaking to a mother whose oldest son had just gone off to Texas A&M and to study psychology. Well, psychology, ever since Freud, the major theories in that field have been secular and often explicitly anti-Christian. Freud said that Christianity is an infantile regression, meaning you're immature if you're a Christian. It's a projection of a imaginary father figure in the sky because you're just too afraid to grow up. And it's very hostile to Christianity, and this young man came from a good, warm Christian home and a good Christian church, but he had not been equipped to answer the questions that were now being raised in the classroom. And within a semester, he completely washed out, lost his faith, and when I talked to his mother, 2-3 years later, he still was wondering, you know, what was really true. So I'm also thinking in terms of equipping young people to face the challenges that they're going to face. There have been studies, more than one. I cite at least 2 studies in Finding Truth, of why do people deconvert? And the research is expected to find some kind of emotional wounding or relationship issues that cause people to walk away from their church. But to their surprise, the most frequent answer given for why people deconverted from Christianity was they couldn't get answers to their doubts and questions. The single most frequently given answer. So Finding Truth, my new book, is designed to help young people think through the challenges they're facing in the classroom, or parents and teachers and pastors who are helping young people to prepare them for the challenges of an increasingly post-Christian world.
Well, Nancy, maybe we should just, you know, give you a chance to, you know, share a little bit about your story, because we've talked before, but you were kind of in that same place, right? Don't think, just believe. That was that's kind of how you got started on your journey, right?
Absolutely. You are right. And that's another reason I'm so passionate about this issue. Is my story was I was in high school. I was about midway through high school, and I started having questions. I was raised in a Christian home, and I started asking, how do we know this is true? I wasn't rebellious. We assume that kids who walk away from the faith are rebellious or, you know, want to party, do things that are immoral. But it was none of that. I just wanted to know, how can we know Christianity is true? And none of the adults in my life, my parents, my pastor, had any answer to that. I even talked to a Christian professor. I thought he would have some thoughtful answer. I said, why are you a Christian? He said, works for me. I thought, well, it's not working for me. I had a chance to talk to a seminary dean. Surely someone with that kind of theological training would have answers. But all he said to me was, don't worry, we all have doubts sometimes. As if it were just a psychological phase I was going through. So I finally decided that if Christianity had no answers, then the only intellectually honest thing to do would be to reject it. How can you say you believe something if you have no reasons? So that's what I did. At about age 16, I rejected my Christian upbringing and started on a search for truth. And I started walking down the hallway to the library at the public high school I attended and pulling books off the philosophy shelf, because I thought, if Christians don't have any answers, maybe it's philosophy where people deal with questions like, what is true? And what is the meaning of life? And is there an objective basis for my moral choices? And these were the questions I was asking. So when I finally, years later, when I was going to school in Germany, I happened upon the ministry of Francis Schaeffer in Switzerland, which was called Labrie. And that was the first time I heard anyone who could offer some kind of apologetics, who could offer reasons and arguments in favor of Christianity. I was stunned. I had never heard that before. Like you said, up until then it had been, don't think, just believe. So it was remarkable to me to find Christians who actually engage with the questions of our day engaged with the questions that secular people were asking, because by then I was completely secular. In fact, it was so stunning that I left. I fled. I was afraid that I might be drawn in just because it was so fascinating to me, so appealing to me to talk to intelligent Christians, that I, after only a month at LaBrie, I left. But because of my stay at LaBrie, I had discovered apologetics. I discovered C.S. Lewis, G.K. Chesterton, in addition, of course, to Francis Schaeffer himself. And just through my own reading, I became convinced that Christianity was true. And then I thought, or as I thought at the time, God had won the argument. And then I was so disconnected from Christians that I thought, where do I find them? Well, I knew some at LaBrie. So I went back to Switzerland, back to LaBrie, and stayed for 4 months. And that's a year and a half later. And that's where I really got grounded in a Christian worldview. So this is why I am so concerned that we learn to answer young people's questions. Otherwise, they're driven away. They're driven away from their Christian faith. There's studies done on what ages people are most likely to reject Christianity. And the ages are, not surprisingly, high school and college years, especially the later high school and college years. So that's where the church and parents and pastors should be putting their resources. They should be focusing on apologetics, answering young people's questions during those years. That should be intensive apologetics teaching during the high school and college years in particular.
Well, in the moments ahead, we're going to provide a little primer, if you will. We're going to share five principles for unmasking atheism, secularism, and other God substitutes as we pursue finding truth. That's the title of Nancy Piercy's new book. Nancy's been heralded as America's preeminent evangelical Protestant female intellectual, and I know you'll enjoy the conversation for the rest of the hour. I want you to stay tuned, and feel free to join in the conversation as well. If you have a question, it's 877-933-2484, 877-933-2484. And we do have a couple of copies of Nancy's new book. Just came out. You can get a copy. You sign up for it. We'll do a drawing at the end of the show, as we do each time, and you can sign up for that. Give us your information at 877-933-2484. More with award-winning author Nancy Piercy in just a moment.
I believe in God our Father. I believe in Christ the Son. I believe in the Holy Spirit. Our God is three in one.
We're talking today about what we believe, and how we understand what everyone believes as we understand their worldviews. Everyone has one. And we're talking about finding truth. And out of that, five principles that can help us understand worldviews and unmask them and share effectively the gospel to be an apologist for the faith. Talking today with Nancy Piercy, who is a well-known author and a professor. And she is also a fellow at the Discovery Institute, editor-at-large at the Piercy Report. And, in fact, she was a founding editor of the radio program Breakpoint. And we're just thankful for her great writing. Total Truth is her award-winning book back in 2005. This new one just came out called Finding Truth. Got a couple of copies to give away if you'd like to be in the drawing. It's 877-93-FAITH. The book is based on some key verses in Romans chapter 1. Nancy, I wonder if you can just maybe let's set up the conversation before we kind of dive into the principles.
Right. In Romans 1, Paul is addressing a congregation that had not heard him speak before. So he's giving a very comprehensive account to people who may not even believe in Christianity yet. And I like to call it Paul's Apologetics Training Manual. Because he gives principles that can be applied to any worldview and make sense of it. For example, he starts out what? He starts out saying those who don't worship the Creator will make an idol out of some part of creation, right? Those who exchange the glory of God for images of something in the created order. Now, we usually think of a statue or a golden calf, but an idol can also be something abstract. Think of the idols that so many people live for, like success or relationships. It can also be something abstract like matter. You know, is matter something in the created order? Well, sure it is. So materialism as a philosophy qualifies as an idol. It makes matter the first cause and source of everything else. So it's a substitute for God. Can reason be an idol? Well, of course. The philosophy of rationalism elevates reason to the ultimate source and standard of truth. So this insight allows us to apply Paul's teaching on idols to the many isms that we encounter in today's pluralistic and multicultural world. See, logically, everyone has to start somewhere. Something has to be posited as the ultimate reality of everything else. Atheists will sometimes say, well, not me. I'm not in the same boat. Our young people are getting a lot of their information these days from the internet, and on atheist websites, they will often see this. Atheism is not a belief. Atheism is merely the lack of belief in God or gods. But it's not possible to think without some starting point. And if you don't start with God, you must start with something else. Most atheists start with matter, materialism, or with nature, naturalism. So in that sense, it levels the playing field. Everyone has to start with something. And the question is, which one is really true? So Paul's teaching on idols applies to the idols of our own day as well as to the idols of the first century.
And I assume that, you know, when Paul was writing this, I mean, there are probably some similarities to Roman culture that fit nicely as we read it today, maybe with fresh new eyes.
Well, for example, Paul says, we all have evidence for God through general revelation, right, through the created order. And in my book, Finding Truth, I quote Cicero. Cicero was a great Roman writer a century before Christ, and he makes an astonishing argument from nature to God. He says, when we see nature running in its regular courses, it's orderly, it's rationally intelligible, we can see that nature is not just random. We ought to be able to conclude that there's a God. He says, not only do we conclude that it's a product of a mind, but of a divine mind. And he has a quote that sounds remarkably modern. He says, you don't see God himself, but by looking at his handiwork, you can discern that there must be a God. So what that means is that even in Cicero's time, even in the Bible's time, people could look at nature, they could look at the created order, and just like Paul says, they could see that it was evidence for God.
But, you know, does evidence sort of carry the same weight that it once did? Haven't we even sort of moved kind of away from that, that it's what the postmodern, do we even look at evidence anymore?
Well, that's why many people said they like Finding Truth, my new book, because it doesn't simply assume a kind of scientific modern mindset that if we just give people the evidence, they'll grab it. It's not an evidentialist approach to apologetics where you just lay out the data. Instead, it is more philosophical. It says, look, everyone starts with an idol. Everyone starts with basic philosophical assumptions, and that will color the way they read everything else. So, for example, let's take postmodernism. My book, Finding Truth, deals considerably and gives considerable time to postmodernism, which is, again, is something that makes it a little unique because most of us have a hard time understanding postmodernism. But postmodernism fails essentially because it collapses on itself. One of the common failings of many worldviews is they commit suicide, is the way I put it. They shoot themselves in the foot. For example, postmodernism says human rationality is swamped by non-rational forces, social forces like race, class, and gender. But if that's true, then that has to apply to their own thinking. Is their own theory just a product of their own race, class, and gender? Are they just mouthpieces for their own social forces? So if you apply their own theory back on itself, it discredits itself. It commits suicide. So postmodernism itself, you see, we can take instead of just being defensive, we can go on the offensive in a positive way. We can say, why should we give in to the postmodern mindset that says there is no truth when postmodernism itself shoots itself in the foot, is self-refuting, it's self-defeating? So one of the five principles that are outlined in Finding Truth is how to show that every non-Christian worldview ultimately commits suicide. It ultimately is self-defeating.
Because anything, I guess maybe we should be a good time to talk about reductionism, right? Because anything that's not centered on God as the creator, right, it's going to substitute something else, and by the very conversation, it's going to it's not going to measure up, right?
Right. That's principle number two, is once you've discovered the idol, then you need to find out how it has a lower view of the human person. Every worldview, you can count on it, will have a lower view of humanity. Why? Because if you don't start with God, you will start with something lower than God, something in the created order. And therefore, you will define humanity in terms of that lower reality as well. If you exchange the glory of God for something less than God, then you will exchange the image of God for something less than God as well. And this gives us an opportunity to give a positive argument for Christianity, because every worldview will be ultimately dehumanizing. And you're right, the connection to committing suicide, being self-defeating, is this. If you have a lower view of the human person, you will also have a lower view of human cognitive faculties, our rationality, our reason. But how do they make their own case then? They have to use reason. So when they discredit reason, they undercut their own case as well. We talked about postmodernism. There's some other examples as well. On the college campus today, Marxism is still very prominent. And Marx says you believe what you believe not because you think it's true, but because it advances your economic interests. That's what really drives people. Well, what about Marx's own theory then? Did he adopt it just to advance his economic interests? Why should the rest of us pay any attention to it then? So it's self-refuting. Or Freud. Freud is still a big name in psychology. He said, we don't believe what we believe because we're rationally persuaded it's true, but because of your psychological history, especially sexual repression. Well, what does that mean for Freud's theory then? Onto the couch yourself, Dr. Freud. A fast-growing movement in the college campus today, in all fields really, is evolutionary psychology, which says that ideas arise in our brains not because of their truth value, but because of their survival value. But if you apply that theory to itself, then it's not a matter of truth either, just survival. So every idol-based worldview ends up with a lower view of human reason. And as a result, when it uses reason to make its own case, it undercuts itself. The only worldview that has a high view of reason is Christianity, because we're made in God's image. We reflect the mind of the Creator. So in essence, every worldview has to reach over and borrow a Christian view of reason when they're making their own case. They have to use the benefits of Christianity, even though they reject Christianity, in order to avoid committing suicide themselves.
Fascinating discussion as we talk worldviews today. We're talking strategic principles, five principles for unmasking atheism, secularism, and other God substitutes. It's the subtitle of Nancy Piercy's brand new book called Finding Truth. And we got some copies to give away. You can sign up for it at 877-93-FAITH. And if you have a question or a comment, we'll get to that as well. We'll get to that right after the break. I got a couple waiting to go. Welcome you to join the conversation as well. 877-933-2484. More with Nancy Piercy, author of Finding Truth, coming up in just a moment. Some important teaching on finding truth today. God's word is true, but in the world in which we live, there are many viewpoints, about worldviews, about what drives people, how they operate, how they think, how they act as a result. And today we're learning five principles for unmasking some of these worldviews, atheism, secularism, other isms, with Nancy Piercy, best-selling author of the award-winning book Total Truth. She is has contributed to several books. She's an editor-at-large of the Piercy Report, fellow at the Discovery Institute. She's teaching at in Houston. Houston Christian University, Nancy? Houston Baptist University. And we're talking about important text in Romans chapter 1, as she describes it, Paul's training, apologetics training manual. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile. Their foolish hearts were darkened. And, of course, you know that passage. It goes on. And, Nancy, out of that, you've built five principles. Let's review them before we get to our calls here.
Right. The first one is that everyone has a God substitute. Everyone has an idol. So if you're analyzing a non-Christian worldview, look for the idol. That will take you to the heart of the worldview. Sometimes people get sidetracked in all the different details, and they say, well, what's really important here? What's really important is, what is its idol? It exchanges the glory of God for something in the created order. The second principle is find the way it dehumanizes people. Every worldview will dehumanize, will have a lower view of the human person, because if we're not made in God's image, we're made in the image of something lower than God. And as a result, every worldview ends up being harmful, having harmful consequences, and leading to violence and oppression. That's why the rest of Romans ends with all those, that long passage of sins and destructive and self-destructive behavior. The third one we actually skipped in our early part of the program, and that's, once you found where it has a low view of the human person, that allows you to test it. Test the idol. And here's what I mean by that. Every non-Christian worldview will have a lower view of the human person, but we can test that against what we know by general revelation. General revelation says that humans are meant to give evidence for God. They're part of the created order too, right? Yeah. So the fact that we are personal beings is meant to give evidence for a personal God. Let me give you just one example of how this works when analyzing a secular worldview. The most dominant worldview in the leadership classes of America and in our universities is scientific materialism. So materialism says there is nothing but matter. Matter is its idol. So it's, how does it deal with the human person? Well, the human person is therefore just a biochemical machine. Anything that doesn't fit in the materialist box, so to speak, is said to be not real. So that's soul, spirit, mind, free will, love, all these things that can't be reduced to matter are said to be unreal. Well, can anyone really live that way? This is how you test it. You test it by saying, can this worldview really work in the real world? Well, no, nobody lives as if love and free will and all of these things were not real. In fact, there's one philosopher who says, if people don't believe in free will, then when they go to a restaurant, they should say, just bring me whatever the laws of nature have determined I will get. So, in other words, even the materialist himself cannot live with his own worldview. So that's principle number three, is test it against the real world. And four was the one we already talked about. Every non-Christian worldview will end up being self-defeating, self-refuting. And the fifth principle is make the case for Christianity. Where you will be most relevant is if you can craft a Christian answer in response to the very things that secular people themselves recognize their own worldview doesn't answer. Like the person who says, my own worldview says, I'm a materialist, you're just a machine, you have no free will, but oh my goodness, we can't live without free will. He's just acknowledged his own worldview doesn't fit. And that Christianity, because we're made in God's image, does have an answer for the human person as we actually experience it day by day.
Well, let's take a call. Karen's listening in Lana Lakes, and a question that maybe others and I have as well is that, you know, what does this look like maybe in the real world? I mean, how do these conversations start? Karen, you're on with Nancy Piercy. Go ahead with your question.
Oh, thank you, and thank you for giving the overview before you came to me, because, Nancy, that gives such clarity that we can just use to acknowledge the supremacy of God. It's so good. And Neil, thank you for bringing to the table every day at noon all these good conversations to stimulate us. It's wonderful. I work at the Minneapolis International Airport, where it is getting increasingly difficult to let anybody know. I mean, they don't even have a chapel there like most airports do. And I feel like I'm living in the book of Queen Esther, where it wasn't safe to share about who your God was. And we do have, there is an FCAP, Fellowship of Christian Airline Personnel, that's a ministry globally that's been around for about 40 years that was started by three pilots because they could never go to church on Sunday, and they support each other. And even with that, where it used to be out there, it's getting kind of scary. And recently the global director for that, for FCAP, who, by the way, also studied under Francis Schaeffer, wrote a book called When God Shows Up at Work, and starting to try to put that in there so that we can connect our faith, because people are seeking. But my question is, how do we share our faith when we're in hiding?
Good question, Karen.
Yeah, that is a good question. You know, a lot of times where we have to start is the implications of the Christian worldview and then gradually draw people in. I used to work for a prison fellowship, and we lobbied for the principle of restitution. In other words, when you commit a crime, it's considered a crime against the state, not against the victim. And so the fees and so on go to the state. Well, that doesn't make sense. We would lobby for the criminal to have to pay, the offender would have to pay restitution to the victim. And people would sometimes say, well, that's a great idea. Where'd you get that? And we'd say, well, you got a Bible? You know, dust it off, open to Leviticus. In other words, you often have to start with the implications of a Christian worldview. And when people say, that's interesting, where'd you get that? Then you draw them back into explaining where it comes from. So that this is one reason we have to have a Christian worldview and not just the theology of the doctrine. Because as long as we're talking theology, we're talking religious language that, you're right, people around us do not understand anymore. A generation ago, when most people were churched, remember that term, churched, you know, they were raised in a church, they understood, you could say you're a sinner and you need to get saved, because they understood what sin was, they understood what salvation was, they understood who God was. But today they don't have that background. We're much more like Paul on Mars Hill, where he doesn't quote any scripture. He doesn't refer to the Old Testament. He quotes their own poets. He quotes pagan poets. He refers to a pagan altar. This is why in many cases today we have to know the worldviews of the people around us and begin on the level of showing how Christian truths respond to their concerns and draw them in more gradually to the theological basis.
That brings up, maybe leads into Kathy's question, listening in the Madison area. It says, if we're supposed to know our audience, what's the best way to keep up with them? You know, changes in beliefs and such. But I mean, in many ways, I guess the worldviews, the isms you've talked about, this has been sort of the thinking of all Western civilization since the beginning, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. It is true that questions change, and we need to be in touch with young people. You know, there's no shortcut. You do have to be paying attention to what young people are saying, and and listening to the media to some degree to discern where the arguments are changing. But Neil, you're completely right. Many of these long-term worldview assumptions have been around for centuries, and Christians need to educate themselves on those. One of the things that Francis Schaeffer was so good at teaching was, if you understand the underlying assumptions, you will be able to figure out where the culture is going, because there are logical implications of your assumptions. Part of worldview thinking is being able to track, if you have certain premises, where is it going to lead? If we had been tracking the secular worldviews, we would not have been surprised, for example, by the 1973 Roe v. Wade abortion decision. And that's where our culture was headed. We would not be surprised by the rapid rise of the homosexual movement today, because we would have been able to anticipate it. It's a natural outgrowth of the presuppositions that people hold. So there's twofold. You do need to be listening to young people and learning their language, just like any missionary. You know, we're called to be missionaries, and we should learn the language of the people we're trying to reach. But secondly, we'll be better equipped for that if we understand these larger themes that tend to hold throughout Western intellectual history and are able to see where they're heading. And so we're not always reactive. We can be proactive, because we'll know where they're going, since they do tend to work out the logic of their assumptions, of their premises.
You know, you talked about being missionaries. I know Paul talks about, you know, that we are ambassadors. And you address that a little bit in the book, Finding Truth. What does it mean to be an ambassador? And if we take on that assignment, then what kind of preparation should we be doing?
Right. The message in Scripture is that we're ambassadors. We're missionaries. We have to train ourselves just as well as any other ambassador. I lived for many years in the Washington, D.C. area, so I knew a lot of graduate students who were getting their degrees in international affairs and so on. And it was fascinating to talk with them, because they all understood the concept of worldview, not because they were reading Christian books on the subject, but because that's what their training consisted of. They were being taught that learning the language is actually the easier part. Learning the worldview of the people you're going to is the tough part. You need to understand how they think, how they see the world, and what are their assumptions, what are their questions. And it was amazing talking with them, because it was it showed why Paul was so right to choose that metaphor, that we too are ambassadors. In the same way, we need to learn the language, but even more important, we need to learn the underlying thought forms and worldviews of the people that we're trying to reach. It's just part of the job description.
Learning the underlying thought forms of the people that we're trying to reach, that is at the heart of our conversation today with Nancy Piercy. We're talking about her latest book, just came out, called Finding Truth. And the subtitle is Five Principles for Unmasking Atheism, Secularism, and Other God Substitutes. It's published from David C. Cook. Nancy Piercy is a best-selling author and a professor, and was formerly an agnostic, and has written and contributed to a number of books and articles. In fact, was the founding editor of the radio program Breakpoint, and is also a fellow at the Discovery Institute. And we'll talk more with Nancy in just a moment. I want to get to something called cognitive dissonance, which is something from George Orwell. We'll even bring that up in the moments ahead. So stay tuned. If you'd like to sign up for a copy of the book, or you have a question, you can join us at 877-933-2484.
I know your truth is still true.
Talking today about Finding Truth, Nancy Piercy, who's a best-selling, critically acclaimed author and a professor, and joining us today to talk about her new book just out called Finding Truth, Five Principles for Unmasking Atheism, Secularism, and Other God Substitutes, and using Romans 1 as the basis for the conversation. And although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools. And the passage goes on to describe what that looks like. And we've been talking about some of these principles of worldview and understand the thinking. And Nancy, one of the phrases you address in the book is cognitive dissonance. I'm wondering, do people that have a worldview that is based on something less than biblical understanding, do they recognize that they're living in this sort of cognitive dissonance?
Yeah, I use the word cognitive dissonance, which is, of course, from psychology, to describe what Paul talks about when he says everyone has evidence for the reality of the biblical God, but they suppress that evidence. How do they suppress it? He says, well, by creating God substitutes, in other words, alternative worldviews. And so, in essence, this is the human condition. Everyone has evidence for God that they acknowledge, but they're suppressing it by constructing worldviews that oppose that. So they're holding two contrary ideas. And that's the definition of cognitive dissonance. What I find really fascinating is that in Finding Truth, I quote several leading thinkers today who acknowledge that they're living in cognitive dissonance. It's amazing. They're willing these days to acknowledge that their worldview doesn't fit what they themselves know to be true by, as we would put it, by general revelation, that this is a body of knowledge that's available to them through universal human experience, and that their worldview doesn't fit it. Let me give you one example. This is the example that my own students always remember the best. It's Rodney Brooks, who's professor emeritus at MIT, used to be the head of their artificial intelligence department. So I'm talking about leading scientists and thinkers, by the way. And he says, okay, I'm a materialist, and I think human beings are just machines, or as he puts it, this is a direct quote, he says, a person is just a big bag of skin full of biomolecules interacting by the laws of physics and chemistry. And then he says, I know it's hard to really see people that way, but when I try, I can see that my children are machines. And then he answers the question, do you treat them like machines then? He said, of course not. I don't treat them that way. I give them my unconditional love. And then he says, I realize that this is not rational. In other words, according to his worldview, his materialist worldview, loving his own children is irrational. It doesn't fit in the materialist box. Love doesn't fit in the materialist box because robots don't love. If you're just a machine, you don't love. And so it's amazing. He ends this passage of his book by saying, I hold two sets of inconsistent beliefs. Now, there's the cognitive dissonance. Because of universal human experience of who we are made in God's image, he loves his children and he knows it. But his worldview is telling him, love is irrational. It doesn't fit in the materialist box. And it's amazing how many materialists and other naturalists, evolutionists, atheists, I collected several examples of leading thinkers who acknowledge that they live in cognitive dissonance. And the biblical interpretation is they're recognizing general revelation because they're recognizing the image of God in humanity. They're saying, I realize, you know, I love my children, I have free will, I have a mind, I have a conscience, all these things that are only possible if we're in the image of a personal God. They recognize that data from their own experience, and they also recognize that it doesn't fit their worldview, that their worldview contradicts it. So it's amazing. The cognitive dissonance is just staggering. What that means, of course, is as Christians, we're the ones who don't have cognitive dissonance. We're the ones who have a worldview that explains human experience as everyone has to experience it, whatever their worldview is. They all know that they love their children. They all know that they have free will. Christianity is the only worldview today that doesn't have cognitive dissonance, that has a consistent, rational, internally coherent worldview. It's ironic since we're often accused of being irrational, but today it's the non-Christian who has a fragmented, internally contradictory worldview. And it's Christianity that still stands for the unity of truth, that there is a consistent whole truth that can be known.
And we just referenced George Orwell. He called it doublethink, which you've sort of described. I mean, that's clearly, you know, they're in this sort of untenable position. And I love you quoted G.K. Chesterton. His assertion was that secularists reject Christianity because it's too good to be true. So let's talk about, I mean, it's not too good to be true, obviously, but how do we begin to build our case, which is your fifth principle, is about, you know, we make the case for Christianity. What are some of the key points to doing that in a winsome way?
Right. Well, once we realize that every non-Christian worldview today has a lower view of the human person, then it opens the floodgates to making a positive case for Christianity. Let me give you some examples. There are secular people who acknowledge that their own worldview gives no basis for human rights, human dignity, equality, and all these wonderful ideals that we all aspire to. Friedrich Nietzsche, for example, sort of arch atheist of the 19th century, said The idea of human rights came from Christianity. It came from the notion of the equality of all souls before God, as he put it. That's the source of human rights. A contemporary atheist, Richard Rorty, who died recently, said the same thing. He said the notion of universal human rights, it was a complete novelty in human history, and it came strictly from Christianity. And this is ironic because Rorty says, I'm an atheist, I'm a Darwinist, an evolutionist, and he says, I recognize my own worldview does not give a basis for universal human rights because in the struggle for existence, the strong win and the weak fall behind. So he says, I'm perfectly happy to reach over and borrow the notion of human rights from our Judeo-Christian heritage. And he calls himself a freeloading atheist. He's freeloading from Christianity what his own worldview doesn't give him. And so in the chapter on how to build a Christian worldview, I said, this is where we should start. We should start where secular people themselves recognize their worldview falls short. And if they want a high view of the human person, a high view of human rights and dignity, they've got to reach over and freeload those concepts from Christianity. So if we start with those issues, we will be focusing on just the points that non-Christians find most appealing, most attractive, and keep reaching over and borrowing from us. So that gives us a fresh take on how to craft a Christian worldview at the points where it will be really relevant to our world today.
Say a bit about maybe how we get past the quote-unquote everyone else is wrong approach.
Yeah, that was a comment that some of my students made when they were reading my books, Finding Truth. They said, every other book on apologetics I've read left me with the impression everyone else is wrong. And in Finding Truth, what I show is that we can have a balanced approach. We can show where every worldview is wrong because it starts with an idol. It starts with something in the created order, and therefore it will never be big enough. If we think of a worldview as like stuffing the whole universe into a box, its box will never be big enough because it's based on part of the created order, and a part is never big enough to explain the whole. So something will always be left out, and that something will then falsify the theory. But because they do focus on some part of the created order, they also get some things right. After all, the materialist focuses on matter, on the material side of the universe. So materialist scientists can often just make great discoveries about the material universe. People who focus on, the empirical world, you're an empiricist, obviously, they're going to focus on some things that are true. Even Marx focused on the economic aspect of human life. Well, he discovered some things that were true. It allows you, postmodernism. Postmodernism focuses on the social groups, race, class, and gender, and how they can shape our thinking. Well, there's some truth to that because God made us as social beings. We're meant to interact with our social environment. So every worldview does focus on some part of the created order. So that's why it will be inadequate, but it's also why we can recognize some truths. And that allows you to have an open, generous, respectful attitude towards any worldview that you encounter, instead of sort of just shutting down and, see no evil, hear no evil, instead of just closing your eyes to all the negative worldviews, we can look for what they have that's true and right and good. And it just in my students, they really liked that approach because it allowed them to be open and respectful, even as they kept their critical thinking intact.
The end of the book has a number of appendices with some great questions and some great opportunities for you to kind of dialogue as a group or maybe just on your own to kind of work through it. It's called Finding Truth. From Nancy Piercy, Five Principles for Unmasking Atheism, Secularism, and Other God Substitutes. Kind of run out of time. Karen in Duluth says, are there any secular universities that are using your books as textbooks?
Secular universities. Now, that I'm not quite sure. Certainly, there are a lot of Christian universities, Christian high schools, and Christian seminaries that are using my book. I have to admit, I haven't heard of any secular universities.
It would seem... They would, well, maybe if they're freeloading, maybe they would. So we'll see.
I guess
we'll
see.
Nancy, it's good to have you on again. Thank you for the great work and just your thoughtful approach to this. And and giving us some great insight today. We're challenged and encouraged, and know that there is a truth out there to find if we pursue it in biblical ways.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nancy Piercy, who is a best-selling, critically acclaimed author. She's also a professor at Houston Baptist University, and joining us today talking about her new book, Finding Truth. It's published by David C. Cook. If you missed part of today's broadcast or would like to hear it again, you can go to our website at myfaithradio.com.